You know what I'm saying? Overnight, and then sometimes when I pull it out off in the morning, it has not charged.
Yep.
And I'm like, what is the point of having a
joint committee on tax reform for June 6th that will come to order? Colleagues, we're continuing our information meeting. Dr. Werner has some additional material on some projections to present. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Werner, let's say revenue officer. As you recall from our meeting last Thursday, we did post in OLS what we called SIM 12. And so I was going to go through that with you today to give you a sense, of, again, about some of the policy levers and how they affect what we think the economic and distribution effects will be. So we have material on that. I'll also point out that we just got last night another redraft of LC 3549. It does have the parameters from SIM 12 in it, but those, of course, are all very preliminary. The main thing is around the structure of the language, and this is very much a work in progress. So we wanted to put this out so we get some feedback on some of the elements of the tax base, how they're defined, and we try to iterate through this. The other development is that the House Revenue Committee sent the Joint Committee a bill, House Bill 2830, and so the next version you see of LC 3549 will be HB 2830-1. And we'll have a vehicle in which you can discuss the contents of the plan.
Excuse me, Paul, just to be clear, so that the LC has been updated today.
Yes.
And it just for mechanics' sake, it'll be put into an actual bill on Thursday.
That's correct, Mr. Co-Chair. And of course, we're already have some suggested changes since this was put together. So we're compiling a list as we go, and so we can let us know as we work through that. But this is basically the language as of the end of last week, I believe. So there's some additional changes in the works, as we expect there to be when you define the base and those deal with those detailed questions. So the SIM 12 that we'll talk about today has several different elements to it. Again, these are all you can think of in terms of policy parameters. We have set the rate threshold at 3 million in this simulation. If you recall, before we had looked at 1 million, this sets the threshold at 3 million. And there's still just a flat $250 fee for those that are above the filing threshold but are below the 3 million. And of course, the mechanics of the rate structure is that for example, if you have 4 million in receipts, then the first 3 million you'd pay 250, and then you'd pay the rate on that increment, that 1 million above the rate threshold. We've structured it so we have four different rates in the system, and these would be defined, and you can see they're defined in LC 3549 as well. We're using the language from the NAICS codes to define what these categories are. And we have a rate of 0.75 for services. As you recall, the thinking behind that is that services are less likely to have intermediate purchases and transactions. They're more likely to be final sales to customers. And they're also less likely to be export-oriented. So we tend to have a higher rate there following the lead that Washington takes in their structure, where they have a higher rate for services. So 0.75% is the rate there. Retail trade is 0.35%. Wholesale trade, 0.25%. And we're also working on some language in the draft that we want to go through over the next couple of days, where to make it clear that if you're a wholesaler and your distribution is outside the state of your product, that we make it clear that the receipts from those selling to that wholesaler will not be subject to the cap. if the ultimate use of that product or the ultimate market for that product is outside the state. So Ohio does this with their qualified distribution centers. We want to make that more general and broader. They have some highly specific requirements, particularly a size requirement. We wanted to make that broader.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Smith, please.
Thank you. Paul, could you just give all of us an example?
Representative Smith, Mr. Co-Chairs, let's say that you're a producer of a product, some type of a tangible product, and you sell it to a wholesaler. And that wholesaler intends to sell, if it's a manufactured product or an agricultural product, that wholesaler will sell that outside of Oregon. Well, the wholesaler is not subject to the receipts tax. It's the producer of the product who sold it to the wholesaler because it's a receipt to them. So we want to set up a system where the producer that sells it to the wholesaler receives a certification that the purchaser, the wholesaler, is going to sell it out of state, and that if that's the case, they would be exempt from the CAT. Because the ultimate destination is outside the state.
Please.
I really want to make sure I understand this because I think this is key to District 57. So if a potato farmer sells their potato to a food processor who then sells that French fry to China, what happens to that food processor who sells that French fry to China?
The food processor that sells the French fry to China, that product would not be subject to the CAT.
They would not pay tax on that French fry.
Right, on what they sell outside the state.
Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Co-Chair, I just want to be real clear as I communicate with folks. So if I understand this correctly, the first $3 million is exempt.
Yes.
So
no, it's not. You pay the flat amount.
You pay the $250.
Right.
Let me be very correct.
Right.
So my little mom and pop clothing store in Hepner's Main Street is going to pay $250 as long as their sales are under $3 million. Mm-hmm. And my food processor at the Port of Morrow is exempt.
That's correct.
Thank you.
That's correct. And you will see, Representative Smith, when I'm going to go through the detail on our simulated employment impacts. We do have hits on the food processing sector, and that's primarily because a portion of that is domestic. And it's within state. So, but the exporting portion would not be subject to the CAT.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to complete the hypothetical, the person growing the potatoes in excess of $3 million, what happens? How are they? What are they? Are they a wholesaler? What are they? Where's the farmer on this?
The Representative Vance, the person who is producing the potatoes and selling them to a wholesaler, if those potatoes are sold outside the state.
No, the hypothetical, excuse me for interrupting.
Please, yeah.
The hypothetical was to sell them to Lamb Weston in Boardman, and they're made into a French fry in Boardman, then they're shipped to China.
If that's the case, then I think it would, Mr. Vice Chair, I think it would depend on the specific language, but I think initially they would be subject to it if that product is transformed. So in other words, if there's some kind of processing that goes on, it would be like if you were selling metal to a manufacturer in Oregon, then they use that metal in their final product and then sold it, that would be subject to the receipts tax. We are, Mr. Co-Chairs and Mr. Vice Chair, looking at some alternative ways to treat the agriculture sector. So that's been a big part of an area that we're discussing. We've looked at lower rates and additional exemptions as well. So it is something we're actively looking at alternatives.
Yeah, that issue is not settled
right.
By any stretch.
Yeah, right. So we had some folks in the Transportation Committee yesterday from Ontario talking about the in excess of 1 billion pounds of onions grown in Malheur County. So this would be a big issue given the huge volume of crops and the incredibly low margins. So this is kind of a big issue. When might we be hearing about what your thoughts are on that?
Mr. Vice Chair, we'll we'll continue to work on that issue. Again, I think if it's the onion producers, though, too, remember that's the export versus the domestic consumption. That's the key on what that what the ultimate portion of the tax is. But we're working on some language around the ag sector now. We should have something for you within the next few days or next week.
All right. Thank you.
So just following down on kind of the outline structure of SIM 12, we have a 0.48 rate for the all other category.
Another question from Representative Vance.
Yeah, I'm sorry. There seems to be an assumption built into this that when those onions make their way to New York or New Jersey or Florida or Texas, wherever they go, they're going to be paying, if those states enjoy the sourcing discussions we've been having, a tax upon their arrival. That kind of, we can't just let the story end as the onions leave Oregon. Are you going to present to us the consequences of taxes paid in those other places and how that reverberates back into this state? In other words, you know what I'm saying. There's lots of ways of managing those taxes paid outside the state on that which we ship out of the state when that money comes back and how those taxes are managed here. So I sure will be interested in seeing, in understanding that aspect of this new approach. And again, this is not old, this is not something new. We already enjoy this when we're on our single sales factor approach. So it shouldn't be too difficult to present to us this new approach.
So. Yes, Vice Chair Benz, I just mentioned too that I think this very discussion is going on at the national level as well,
right,
where you have you know, the so-called border adjustments. So that's a big issue in terms of any kind of type of trading across borders.
Right. Thank you.
So back to the outline, we have a 0.48 rate for all the other, this would be construction would be in this category, for example, entertainment would be under service. So it would be any of the categories that are not above would be the 0.48 rate. And we also, as we talked about earlier, have put in a credit on the pass-throughs, as we've talked about how pass-throughs are treated in this system. A reminder that the way the CAT works, the CAT is a tax at the entity level. So this is an entity-based tax. So it means that the entity, if it's a pass-through, an S corporation, for example, will be liable for the CAT based on their receipts of that entity. So and based on what their industry is. So what this plan does is offset part of that CAT liability through this credit, and the credit goes not to the shareholder, but to the individual entity. So we have a personal income tax structure rate reductions that you're familiar with, cutting a 0.5% off the 5 and 7 bracket, 0.25% off the 9 bracket, and keeping the 9.9 in place. And then the corporate income tax would be eliminated starting with the 18 corporate tax year. Another thing that we're looking at closely is the timing around implementation. And that's a key part of the thinking as we go forward is what's the optimal time or what's the practical time in which to implement this structural change.
Senator Bershager.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Let's go back to the CAT credit. Run through an example with a corporation or an S corp with $4 million of sales. Run through a scenario with that.
Senator Bershager, Mr. Co-Chairs, if let's say they have $4 million, so they pay $250 plus they'd have $1 million in sales that would be subject to the CAT rates. And let's just say that it's 0.5%. So if they paid 0.5%, then it would be, it would be $10,000, be about $5,000 for 0.5%. So that would be a liability. Remember the CAT, one-page CAT form. So you would calculate that, and you would come up with that $5,000 liability, and you'd put that in a box. And then there would be a line below that that would say, if you are one of the following entities, an S corporation, a partnership, you're a Schedule C filer on the personal income tax, then you are eligible for this credit. So multiply your liability by 0.43 and subtract that from your liability. So that's how it would work, and then it would be passed through.
And Paul, why 0.43? Why not 0.53 or 0.63? What's the rationale for 43% tax credit?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative
Mueller,
or
why not 33%?
We do actually have a method in our madness on this. What the target we were shooting for is the repeal of the pass-through special rate. So if you recall, that pass-through special rate, it was part of the previous proposal we've looked at, and that would return those income tax rates to ordinary income as they were prior to 2015. And the target we shot for that rate was just to try to offset the impact of that pass-through special rate with the credit. So, and we targeted 1921 as the biennium in which to try to equalize that. Now, of course, they're growing at different rates. So you can see the pass-through special rate is 277 revenue impact estimate. So our 43% was designed to offset that for that full biennium. Okay. And that's kind of the target we shot for. And of course, obviously that credit is something that's very much in flux and a key part of any plan. So it's something that you could decide on, and it just, you know, it's how you want that to fit in with the overall plan. So that's the outline of what we ran through simulation 12, and you can see the results for simulation 12. And these are getting, I think, pretty familiar. We have the overall economy is the effects are largely small. We have small employment effects of plus 5,000, and we have an investment effect of plus 41 million. And there's actually a slight dynamic effect, positive effect, as the economy overall largely absorbs the tax as we get the benefits from the lower personal income tax rates essentially offset the consumption tax effects from the CAT. You do see an increase in the price levels of 0.11, which we would anticipate to be the case because it's based on receipts in Oregon. So we anticipate that being built partially into the tax structure or into the price structure. So if you look at the distribution there, you can see that one of the changes here is because the lower pass-through rate is a part of this simulation. That was, as you recall from the summary that Chris showed you based on the 15 tax returns, nearly all of that went to those over 200,000 in terms of personal income. So that shows up in the distribution of the overall package. So you have a bigger impact on the above 205,000 group, primarily because of that change. The CAT itself, and you've seen the CAT as looked at separately. The CAT does have the impact on prices, gives it a moderate regressive effect, but overall it's generally proportional, where it's spread much more across a much wider spectrum than is, for example, a retail sales tax when we've run those comparisons. A retail sales tax is more concentrated at the lower end, whereas the CAT rate does pick up that, particularly the receipts income, some of that is absorbed in the business sector and those owners of capital, and so it's more proportionally distributed than is the retail sales tax. So what we've done is take a look at a little bit more detail. First, go through the employment effects.
Senator Bershaker, did you have another question?
I'll follow up.
Okay, thank you.
So as you recall, we did spend some time looking at some of the detail. This is the output from our CGE model, and it goes by sector, and so it's a what we call input-output model. So these sectors are buying from each other, and they're either selling their product into Oregon or they're selling it outside of Oregon. So really, it's there are two regions in the model. There's Oregon and there's the rest of the world. So where you tend to see the beneficiaries are those that are export-oriented, as we've talked about, because the tax really doesn't affect them. And you see some employment effects. The employment effects are caused partially by that and also by the impact through the personal income rate reductions, particularly those that have a relatively lower wage structure that benefit from that, those reductions in the lower brackets. So, for example, the ag and natural resource sector has a positive employment effect, but we do have, as I mentioned earlier, a negative employment effect on food processing, and primarily that's because a portion of that is domestic oriented rather than exported. So you've got things like dairy, for example, that are consumed within the state that would we may have some adverse effect. You can see in general the manufacturing sectors have small positives. So, for example, pulp and paper products, semiconductors have small positives. And then if you look at the sectors that are most affected, and this is in general a result we found from GRT type taxes like the CAT, is the wholesale and retail trade sectors, because that's where we see a large volume of receipts. And they're a domestic producer, and so there's where we see our employment losses are in those two sectors. And we did see a similar result from Measure 97. Those were the sectors that were most affected. They're also the sectors that end up paying the higher proportion. Now, we've adjusted somewhat to that effect, as you recall, through the rate structure. The retail and wholesale sectors are paying a lower rate, and that was partially in response to these impacts in those sectors. You can also see that in general, the service sectors, even though they're paying a higher rate, are beneficiaries primarily from increased demand. A lot of that could be coming from the public sector. Business services, for example, health services, both have increases, and this is due to the mix of purchases that are made by the public sector. And what we did with the public sector is make the simplifying assumption that, as I've told you before, we don't have a real sophisticated budget here. We're not looking at, you know, the detailed categories of the budget. We have education, non-education, and we've split this in two. And basically what this is showing is that the those sectors would, if you added them up, would generate an increase of about 3,600 increase in public sector employment as a result of the additional revenue that's coming into the state. By the way, one of the things you'll notice as you go through 3549 is that the revenue from the CAT is dedicated to education, to the state school fund, general fund for state school fund purposes. So that's how the structure of the bill reads right now.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I apologize for interrupting. This is just so important. I want to make sure I thoroughly understand it.
I think it's important, too. Please go ahead.
So, Paul, as I'm looking at your chart here, I'm confused on the food processing section of it. We just talked about that scenario at the Port of Morrow, and yet it shows within the number of jobs an actual decline. I'm trying to figure out how to reconcile that. Can you help me?
Yes, Representative Smith and co-chairs. I think that what's happening in terms of the model is there is still a significant domestic sector for food processing. Dairy products come to mind, but there's a lot of food processing that is sold within the state for consumption within the state. And I think that's where you're seeing the negative effect, whereas that which is export-oriented going outside the state is not subject to the CAT.
Got it.
So I think it's those two forces that are at work.
Got it. Just a quick follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And again, I'm trying to get my arms around this. I do want to point out to the committee that while the bill may dedicate the revenue to education, there's no guarantee it remains there.
Yes.
And with a simple 31 vote, or with a simple flip of the pin, the co-chairs have the ability to redirect those dollars elsewhere. So I just think it's important for us, those of you on who are not on Ways and Means, to understand how simple it is to redirect those dollars. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes, and we know that at noon today we'll be seeing the state school fund. Yes.
And while I support them going to education, Mr. Co-Chair, strongly support that, it is very easy for that to switch.
Senator Hass?
Thank you. Paul, why is there such an increase in other ag and natural resources? Why is that job up 700?
Mr. Co-Chair, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that it's export-oriented. It's all export-oriented in that sector. You know, you have some, you've got the greenhouse and nursery products, which is a separate category as some domestic, but the ag and natural resources is largely exported, so not subject to the cap. And also, I think that sector is a low-wage sector, so it benefits from the employment impacts with the you got a proportionally larger reduction for the 5 and 7 brackets. So I think there's a labor supply response going on there as well. But I think it's largely because it's nearly all export-oriented.
Yeah, please, yeah.
Do these factor in the below $3 million threshold? It seems like that would have an effect on small business jobs, the mom and pops.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, it definitely does. And I think that's part of the difference here between the ag and the food processing. The food processing is more likely to be over the $3 million threshold. We don't, we don't calculate this on an individual business basis, but we calculate an effective tax rate by sector. And so if that sector tends to have us be populated by a large number of small firms below the $3 million, then their overall effective tax rate would be less.
Senator Boquist, please.
Thank you. I'd like to follow up on Representative Smith's question and actually have you walk through an example with us. Both he and I would be interested in. Tillamook County Creamery Association. There's the dairy example you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. It has a liquid, obviously a liquid product, which the liquid product is basically domestically consumed. It has a cheese product, which of course is export-oriented. But help us understand from the cow to the export market. And the reason I say that is you have the dairy farmer who is selling the milk to the association. Then the next step is you have the association which is producing and actually edges of both of our districts. And then you have the export cheese. So how does it impact the dairy farmer? How does it impact, because they pay taxes too, and this pass-through? Could you just walk through that scenario, especially since the president of Tillamook County Creamery Association is the one who told us they want to do something?
And of course, I agree with Senator Boquist. We want to have that. Given the specificity of that particular question, I wonder if it makes sense to have him come back and try later.
I'm going to insist on it, Mr. Chair. And the reason being is that we asked him this specific question previously as an example
we did.
A couple of weeks
ago.
And they've been
you.
Working on this to mm-hmm. figure out what the income differentials are, so on and so forth.
Thank
so
you.
At least
forgotten.
If you could outline the parameters to us since we are getting ready to go into hyperdrive, I think.
I'd forgotten that conversation.
Okay. Mr. Vice Chair and co-chairs, I think the Tillamook Creamery and large producers like that are, you know, that's part of that impact on food processing, I think, that you see. And it's because of that kind of hybrid nature. They are, you know, Tillamook, and I don't know the percentages, but they obviously are export-oriented, export a sizable portion of the value of the product that they produce. But they also produce a lot within the state. And they're also fairly large, so they're going to have a large receipts base, and which would be subject to the cap. So that domestic portion would be subject to the cap, and they would be paying that 0.48 rate under the scheme we have here. So they would be subject. The farmer that sells to them would be, in most cases, probably below the threshold in many cases. The product is to be exported, what we have, and we have language in the draft that would say that if Tillamook purchases this product and then exports it outside the state, then they would not be subject to the CAT. but if they process it within the state, they potentially could be. So what we would do is, this is an area where we're looking at, particularly the ag sector, whether we want to have a specific rate, for example, or have specific exemptions for that sector. And that's the thing that we're looking at the details of now. And we've looked at simulations with lower rates for the entire sector, like 0.15. So we've been looking at some of those scenarios.
So, and this same issue would apply to onion growers, potato growers, and maybe to a less extent wheat, but at least to onion, in which you're doing packaging and doing value added, this same problem would apply to those same agricultural producers, correct?
Potentially it would. It would partially apply. The options to deal with that would be either a lower rate or an outright exemption.
Thank you. I like eating Tillamook 3-year-old sharp cheddar cheese, and so some of that is sold in Oregon. But I had a different question, forgive the psychologist for talking about the base numbers. Part of my training was to actually understand what numbers mean and what the significance of them is. And I note that in your chart here, these are actual numbers of jobs. This is not a multiple of something.
Yes.
So in the first category, for example, there are 18,522 jobs in that livestock sector. And based on your projections, you think there might be a decrease of 27 of those jobs. Now, my question really is, what's the significance of that number? It really doesn't have any, does it? Because so many other things are impacting the employment in the livestock sector or any other of these sectors, that when you're dealing with numbers that small, they really don't mean anything, do they, except that the effect of this change is essentially zero. Isn't that true?
Mr. Co-Chair,
that's your job.
Mr. Co-Chair, I would say that you know, of course, this is a simulation, and you're right that if these impacts are small, they're probably going to be washed away with the changes from in the current law forecast. These are not saying there's going to be 27 layoffs.
Right.
These are saying that this industry is going to have a lower equilibrium out there in the future than it would otherwise have. So that's an important piece. But I think, too, in terms of interpreting this chart, rather than to take the numbers literally, which there's, of course, a wide variance possible, but it does, I think, as a policymaker, I think it gives you a sense of where are those pressure points. And here I'm talking primarily about wholesale retail trade,
yep.
So it gives you a sense on that. And also it confirms some of the ideas around the export sectors are largely undamaged or actually have small gains. And then, of course, the sectors that work with the public sector. So it kind of gives you a rough outline of where those positive and negative effects will be. But, yeah, I certainly agree that to literally take these numbers as a point prediction is not a good way to look at it.
Thank you. Even in the one you're talking about, retail trade except restaurants, I think, is one of them.
Right.
Even that, it's less than half. It's around half of 1%, maybe 0.6 tenths of 1% effect. Well, I guess what I'm trying to get at is if half of the country decided suddenly to become vegetarians, the loss in the livestock sector would be much, much, much larger. Based on that fact, not on this tax measure, isn't that right?
Yes.
And on the other hand, if people decided to eat more beef, it would be the other way, yes. Wouldn't it?
That would be a change in consumer tastes.
Yes.
And that would be a significant change. Tastes, income, technology, all of those things are held constant.
And please, I want our internet audience to know that I continue to eat beef. thank you, Senator Taylor, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. I just wanted to, building on some of the comments, I wanted to go back to a number had been thrown out in the past about for the number of companies with $3 million sales or less. And is it accurate, Dr. Warner, that it's something around 92% of the companies in Oregon would be excluded from this? Is that approximately correct?
Senator Taylor, yes, I think that's generally correct. I'm looking for my chart. But in fact, as we were looking at 5 million. I think it was even higher than that. So I guess 3 million would be somewhere around 95%, I think. That's if you include those that are below the filing threshold, which we think are roughly 100,000 would be below the filing threshold based on the Washington data.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Barnhart. So building on that, I think that's a very, very important point about how the number of businesses that will be excluded from the tax at all. And then on top of it, maybe it would be helpful for the committee to show the percentage change between the two, because although we are seeing here this decline of potentially 1,700 jobs in retail, trade, except restaurants, boy, that's a wide range. That's statewide. The impact of that, that's the biggest decline. How that really would work, how that would play out statewide, that could be a very, very minor potential change. Mm. So can you give us some examples of exactly, I mean, when I think of these different codes that are used here, retail, trade, except restaurants, boy, that's a very, very large distribution statewide. And I think that it's within the margin of error. So I just was wondering if maybe putting in a percentage change here would show the committee how little of an impact it probably would have on employment.
Yes. Okay. Senator Taylor, I would agree completely with you. And it's kind of back to something I know I've said a number of times before the revenue committees, is that, I think that the bottom line in terms of our models is that state and local taxes do matter. I mean, they do affect the economy, but not very much. And that's basically what this data is showing us, that we can look at changes, and they're logical where you would see them occur, but they're not big. Right. They're pretty minor.
That's just what I wanted to emphasize.
And if we go 5 years into the future, they're going to be something that's going to be washed away by the general changes in the economy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Buehler, please.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnhart. A couple questions, Paul. When you did your modeling, what percentage of payroll is going to, in the public sector, to post-employment benefits? What's that percentage of salary that you've modeled for in terms of PERS contribution and health care?
And what
are you basing that assumption on?
The way we've estimated the employment impacts, the public sector has a certain level of expenditures, and it has expenditures. Those expenditures are associated with a certain level of employment. So, what happens when? So, for example, we would assume that the same proportion of state expenditures would be spent on employment as currently are. So we hold that constant. So now you've got, let's say it's 50%. So if you increase the public sector spending by 50%, then 50% would go to current employees, and that's the level of detail the model's at. Those proportions are assumed to stay the same.
Well, I'm going to push back on that. I don't think that's a fair assumption. I think it's pretty clear that our contribution to post-employment benefits is going to climb over the next decade because of the clear forecasts of PERS liabilities. And if we are putting more into current employee benefits, that means we have less dollars to hire more employees in that sector.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Buehler, I certainly agree that trend is out there. We know it's there. But again, in terms of the modeling, we're not projecting the trend. We're projecting how, given those trends, how would this policy affect them? And so we're saying, okay, if the public sector has more revenue than it does in the current forecast, there's likely to be more employment in the public sector than there would be otherwise. So it's not saying that a certain proportion is not going to PERS. I mean, that's in the baseline projections. So these are just marginal changes from the baseline.
And tell me about the real estate sector. So if I buy a house, is there going to be a tax on that transaction?
Representative Buehler, if you're as an individual buy a house, no. If you are an entity, you potentially could. If you're buying multiple houses, buying and selling houses, and that becomes part of your receipts, you could potentially if you meet the criteria. But if you were to buy a house as an individual, no. You would not be you would be, in the language of the bill, an excluded person.
And
yes, please.
How about a real estate corporation that's selling houses? Would they have to pay this tax?
A real estate corporation could potentially be subject to the CAT if they meet their receipts and requirements. They could potentially be subject to the CAT.
And just one final question.
Mm-hmm.
And then how confident are you in the Oregon Department of Revenue can transition their administrative and IT infrastructure to accommodate this new tax?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Bueller, certainly that's something we've had some conversations with them. One of the issues is partly to reflect to make sure they have adequate time is to talk about a potential phase-in time period. So those are things that would be part of this. We do have, as we've talked about, we do have some examples from other states recently that have made these kind of transitions. So we do think that the most difficult thing, I think, for the department is going to be that period of time where you're phasing in the CAT at the same time you're phasing out the corporate income tax. So, I mean, that would be something that would take resources to manage both of those processes. But I think in the long run, this is actually going to be a system that would be easier to administer.
Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you, Chair. So we've talked a lot about who will not pay underneath this tax scheme. But obviously, if we're going to raise new revenue, someone's going to be paying the taxes. And so our job, I think, is to make sure that the tax mechanism that we set out is as equitable as possible and that we use the revenues that are raised as good investments. So the good investments part is really not quite part of what our mission is here today, but certainly ensuring that a tax is as equitable as possible is certainly within our purview. So my question to you is, with the adjustments to agriculture, which you noted you're still working on, do you think that what you've laid out in front of us is about as equitable as we can get in terms of distributing the tax burden fairly?
You want to put up the other?
Yeah.
We have the distribution of the tax burden. Representative Marsh, one of the things that OTEM produces is, and we start with a base where what we think the current distribution is, and this is based on full incidence. So we've built into the baseline how certain taxes affect wages, prices, and try to come up with a baseline distribution, and you can see our baseline distribution is that middle column, which we call the baseline effective tax rate. And you can see for the households overall, it's 8.9%. And we've talked with the committees before that we do see a regressive tail and a progressive tail at either end. But the rest of the system is largely proportional as it's kind of a U-shaped. So in terms of the impact of this proposal, SIM 12, which of course is still very much in progress, you can see where we think the impacts will be. We do see an uptick in the lower end, the less than 20,000 group. And the reasons for that, we've talked about the consumer prices going up, so that hits that group. And also, they don't really benefit much from the lower rates because they don't really pay much in income taxes. So they're not beneficiaries of those lower rates. Who does benefit from those lower rates, more than enough to offset the consumer prices, is the 20 to 48,000 group. And you can see they actually get a decrease in their effective tax rates by our estimates when you build in these wage and price effects. Then you see, as you go up the scale, you can see the impact is going growing as these folks proportionally get less from the rate reductions and proportionally, and then they also are affected as you get up to the higher group by the elimination of the special rate for pass-throughs, and that particularly hits the above 205 group where they have the biggest their increase is largest in dollar terms and percentage is about 0.3%. So what we're saying is that we think, and we my X percent exported up there, I should explain, that's what's exported in the model. Before we do this calculation, we take 25% off the top of the CAT for federal deductibility. So this would be in addition to that. And so there's 252 in net burden to distribute annually from our SIM, and you can see how it affects. It's about a 0.717% increase in the effective tax rate. Again, this is after wages and prices have adjusted. So that's how we think this proposal would affect it, and we can run this diagnostic on any proposal. So, and your tools, of course, can affect different groups differently in the income spectrum.
Thank you, Representative Noss.
Thank you. Dr. Warner, I'm wondering if something that we could do takes us back to where we were in January, which is if we put this model in place, what does our Ernst & Young study of the overall business tax burden look like in the state? Are we in the middle? Are we in the bottom quartile or quintile? You know, are we suddenly super high? Because we know, you know, the overall tax burden in the state, you know, I know our corporate income tax is in the middle, but our overall burden due to a lack of sales tax is, you know, we're down there pretty close to, you know, the lowest tax burden for business in the United States. So if we implement this, where would that put us in that Ernst & Young study?
Representative Noss, we can look at that. We've, of course, we looked at this that with 97, and we also looked at with 67, too. So we'll take a look at that.
Okay. I want to make sure we have a fair system and it's understandable and we can implement it. But I get that that is part of our mission here. But we all, you know, to Representative Marsh's point, we are trying to raise money for schools and services, and you know, and other states have larger business tax burdens and seem to be doing just fine.
Yeah, we'll look at that.
Thank you, Representative Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Colleagues, before I make my statement, I want to admit I don't know what I don't know. And as a new member of Revenue, I want to share that. One of the things I'm struggling with, I'm going to get to a question, but one of the things I'm struggling with is trying to figure out what currently is so Republican about the income tax. And let me tell you what I mean by that. If you do your homework, in the state of Ohio, it was Republican governor, a Republican Senate, and a Republican House that instituted effectively the model that is being brought before us. And what's really interesting for folks who don't know this, the OEA, the Ohio Education Association, opposed it. And now it's flipped. And so I think, Mr. Chair, it would be very fascinating, especially knowing how important this issue is, at some point in time for us to, as a committee, to step back and to study and analyze how did Ohio bring their concept forward and why at some point. I've had an opportunity to study it, and it's absolutely fascinating how in Oregon the politics have flipped.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. If you did some reading, I think some of the rest of us would like to see that.
It's fast. I'll actually forward it on. There was a great 3 or 4 page study completed on this that analyzed how the process played out and why they did what they did. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to me, in Oregon, all of a sudden, Republicans are opposing what was done by a Republican in Ohio, and it's just the whole model split.
Well, it is interesting. I'll make a quick comment. The first income tax, of course, was proposed and adopted by Republican Congress and Republican President Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War. Representative Johnson, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Paul, I've had some conversations with some representatives of the construction industry that I know pretty well, and they're concerned about, they're a very high volume industry, really low margins, but what they're also concerned about is the impact of pyramiding within the industry itself. Obviously, multiple trading, multiple transactions, you talk about the variety of subcontractors, and we start talking about really big capital projects. And one of the impacts of what's being proposed here that they brought up, which I hadn't thought about, and I wouldn't expect you to model either, would be the impact on capital construction for the state of Oregon. And especially as we're talking about a transportation package of some billions of dollars, to where these sectors are going to be impacted by this increase in cost. And their point is that the state of Oregon will receive less benefit for those dollars for that the taxpayers are providing in multiple ways, obviously at the pump and registration and so forth. There'll be fewer projects. But as we talk about cap construction of universities, colleges, and so forth as well, there will be an increase in those area sectors too. And I wonder if there's any kind of way for LRO to model what the impact would be on a pass-through for S-Corps, they'll have to pass this on. It will become a part of their bottom line. So if there's any kind of way you might be able to just to model the impact of what this would do on cap construction projects that will be financed by the state of Oregon.
Representative Johnson, we can certainly look at that. We thought about the construction sector, and I do think it is a domestic sector. So, you know, these are Oregon receipts. So those that are over the threshold could be affected, and of course, pyramiding is a risk. I think what we would see, something like this becomes law, we would see some structural adjustments. For example, one of the things that's exempted in this from the CAT is sales among closely related entities. So that, for example, they have a combined return. Mm-hmm. So that kind of, there would be some incentive to go in that direction. So I would expect to see some of that. But I also think you're right that you would see that built into the overall price level because these guys are competing with each other.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's going to be putting one necessarily at a competitive disadvantage. And if there's any construction industry that's selling into the state, they would be potentially subject to it as well. So, but it's something we could look at in terms of examples. Mm-hmm. And Chris has looked a lot at kind of the different entities. If you're large enough, of course, and a C corp, then you would have the advantage of elimination of the corporate income tax could offset a portion of this. But the construction industry in general, I think, is more fragmented and tends to have more of its sectors that are organized as pass-throughs. So we can look at those specific examples.
Thank you. Senator Boquist, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have two questions. First is actually relatively simple, I think, and that is an observation more than a question for everybody to remember. Is that we've talked about these thresholds, and this person's going to pay and that person's not going to pay, and of course that's just for the record, that's not true. Okay, everybody's going to pay. The question is when you pay and where you pay. So as example, if you are under the $3 million threshold, you're still, as a S corp or a partnership member, going to pay your income tax like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, if you're a C corp and there is a dividend distributed out, or you're an employee of that entity, you're going to pay too. So I just want to make sure the record everybody understands there's nobody getting a free ride out here. It's just where you pay and how you pay for the structure. And speaking of paying, Paul, here's the question. On the top line of your screen over there, in the regressive portions of that, in which individuals making less than $20,587 have an increase through a exemption change or a standard deduction change, could that not be turned into a negative? More or less, could we not make it more, I guess, progressive and less regressive by doing minor tweaking at the bottom with either the exemption or with the standard deduction, given that they cap out in some of these brackets anyway?
Mr. Vice Chair, yes. I mean, especially around the income tax, you've got tools, targeted tools, earned income tax credit, exemption credit. And there's even, there was even a credit that around just a low income household credit that was, for example, part of Measure 1 in 1993. We've looked at those kind of examples in the past, too, where you would have a credit based on family size and income. So it kind of scaled up as it gets smaller. Another example that we've thought about, too, a very targeted one, would be a circuit breaker. which you could target low-income individuals to give them a credit based on their property taxes. Because as you saw from this, the current baseline is the primary reason for that regressive tail is the residential property tax.
Thank you.
Yeah, this number includes all the taxes that we know about, doesn't it?
Mr. Co-Chair, not
federal,
this,
but everything else.
This includes all state and local taxes paid by residents. Oregon state and local taxes paid by residents, not federal, and not taxes that we may pay that are exported to us from other states.
Great, thank you. Senator Taylor, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnard. I just wanted to follow up on comments were made earlier about DOR's ability to implement the tax. And just wanted to remind folks that there was, how many years did it take to implement the gen tax system, Dr. Warner? How long is that? About 3 years or so?
The gen tax system, it was phased in over a 3-year period, and they were phased in with different modules going corporate and then personal and then withholding.
Right.
And so they did that in phases.
Follow up? So the gen tax system is, we have the technology right now within the Department of Revenue to implement the tax. We don't need to make any additional investments in a system.
Senator, I would let them answer that more specifically. I know it would require a new module for them to set up because mm-hmm. this is a new tax and it's based on it.
Right.
So you'd have new forms and a whole new system. So there, I'm sure there are some startup costs there associated with this from them. So that would be, you know, we would look for a clear explanation and plan from them as to how they would implement.
Thank you. I stand corrected. Of course, it'd be some sort of startup cost because it would be a new tax. But the major lift is already there is really my only point, and that perhaps it would be helpful for the committee at some point to have them come up for a few minutes and explain at another time, if we were to go forth with this, what the implementation would look like so that everyone could be assured that the Department of Revenue would be able to implement the tax. So.
Yeah, they wouldn't be reconciling any tax returns until no earlier than April of 19, would they, if the thing went into effect in January of 18? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Representative Hernandez, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
I got one.
Thanks. I have a question regarding comparison of our current corporate income tax and the CAT in terms of, and I know we saw charts earlier, but in terms of if we were to go into economic recession, the comparisons between what would happen in our current system and what would happen with this simulation. I know we've seen something in the past, but not with this simulation. Is there a way that we could have both how much revenue it brings in through the bienniums for our current system and this new proposed tax, and if there was an economic recession, what these two would look like compared to each other?
Representative Hernandez, yeah, we the OTIM model itself is it doesn't track the business cycle. But one of the things we've done, and we can certainly do, and I think could address your question, is we have, under the current system, we've looked at, for example, take what our projection is for 1719, current law projection, and then assume that we have a recession similar to, say, a mild recession that we've had on average. And then we've also looked at what if we have a repeat of 07-09. So we can do that. We're set up to look at that. And we can look at it under two scenarios. One is under current law. And I know under current law, you're basically two standard deviations from the forecast. So you'd be looking at, $2 billion roughly in that area, two to $2.2 billion difference. Under this type of structure, the corporate income tax is not large. It's only 5%. So you eliminate a very volatile component, replace it with a much more stable one. But but you still have in the system, you still have our general fund, especially, is still going to be dominated by the personal income tax. So we're still going to be very sensitive to the business cycle, but this would reduce that range of the magnitude of the decline. But we'll look at some specific numbers for you. You can see how that would, if something like 07, 09 were to occur again under this system, to see what it would look like.
We've had a lot of questions and discussions off. They're sort of only semi-related to the main point. I'd like to take the last 7 or 8 minutes to let you talk about the comparison between 12 and 12L and how you got to 12L and what its significance is, if any, in your modeling system. I'm very well aware we could take up all the rest of the time with questions that don't allow you to talk about the work you've been doing, and I'd like to hear that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah, that's the last piece of information we have for you, other than the LC, is simulation 12L. And remember, we talked about these, we had an M and L last time. The baseline projections, we assume, are a five-year period, a five-year interval, which we think is a rough measure of how long it takes for the economy to respond to the tax changes. So it's looking at that tax changes. The public sector is a spender in that system. It gets more revenue or less revenue, and then it spends more or less depending on changes in revenue. But its impacts are only demand-oriented, so it hires people and buys from other sectors. But the other aspect of the potentially of the public sector is this investment component. And so we do have a parameter in the model, and we've looked at what we call the medium term, which would be 10 to 15 years, and a long term, which would be a longer term, we're assuming around 20 years. If the public sector were to make investments that ended up increasing the productivity of the economy, what would that look like? And you talked a lot about there's a big step going from giving the public sector more money and having productive investments. That's something that the model's not going to be able to help you address. That's really a management issue of how public sector resources are managed. But what the model does is it runs a simulation saying that we know that theoretically the public sector does impact productivity. We see it in education. We gave you a lengthy a day put together a lengthy literature review on the links between education and productivity. So if you get those kinds of gains, if those resources are effectively used, then you get the output that you can see in the simulation 12L. So it's just taking those same numbers going out further. A couple of things to remind you about what we see in that kind of a simulation. Number one is you see a little bit more employment, but not much. So you're gaining 7,500 jobs versus 5,000. So the productivity side on the public sector doesn't necessarily add a lot more jobs. What it adds are income. You can see income and per capita income are both higher, and investment is significantly higher. And this is private investment, so we would anticipate there's a complementary investment. The public sector invests in infrastructure. The private sector will invest, to transportation being the classic example. And the price levels are slightly higher. You get a much bigger dynamic revenue effect, positive effect. And if you look at all of our income groups in general, all benefit from the increase in the overall economic activity. They do tend to be skewed more toward the middle range, middle to upper middle range, as those higher wages, higher paid jobs from the education sector end up with a more productive labor force and people in the higher wage brackets. So there is some structural change that would take place. So again, these are projections, scenarios based on the assumption that the public sector resources are effectively and efficiently used to increase the productivity of the state economy. And there's, as I say, a big jump from here to there, but certainly we've seen it historically in a lot of instances where the public sector has been critical to growth, going back to the beginning of our country's history.
So just to make sure I understand it, I think what you've said is that the sim without the letter at the end is the equilibrium that's reached fairly quickly without much impact on the indirect improvement that comes as a result of education over the long haul and other factors of the similar sort. I think better health in the populace and so forth that come about as a result of state spending, whereas the L version does include that as a long-term effect. Have I got that more or less right?
That's correct, Mr. Co-Chair. It's the equation we have allows us to simulate what would be the effect of the relationship between public sector spending and overall productivity in the mm-hmm. economy.
And so, my editorial comment is that it's an economist's way of describing the fact that most of us believe that education is a good thing and having a healthy population is a good thing.
Yes, and we certainly know that the opposite is true. With a less educated labor force, you don't grow as much and you have lower income.
Yeah, thank you. There were some questions that were hanging over, and since we have a couple more minutes, let's go back to those. Representative Vance?
Paul, could you return to your distribution of tax burden? I just had two questions about the form. Is the baseline effective tax rate, is that reflective of your draft reform plan's new personal income tax rate structure, 4.5, 6.5, 8.75, or what? How do those new rates factor into that baseline effective tax rate?
Vice Chair Benz, the baseline effective tax rates are the current law estimates. Right. So that's where we're starting from. And then the change in the net burden is the combination of that package. It's the impact of SIM 12 on the current law. So SIM 12 includes those rate reductions. And that's, you see that in that 20 to 48 group, you'll notice they get a reduction in their tax burden, a small one, but nonetheless a reduction, whereas everybody else gets an increase, because proportionally, they're the major beneficiaries of the lower rates in the 5 and 7 bracket. And they also are not adversely affected by the elimination of the pass-through rate, because that's predominantly at the higher end.
Thank you. And then at the top, you have a percentage of export, tax export at 17.59%. Do you have a comparison number of what's exported now?
Vice Chair Benz, that's our current export ratio based on the structure of the economy now. So this does not include the deductibility of the CAT. That is in addition to the 17.59. So what we're saying is that this change, absent the federal deductibility of the CAT, 17.9% is exported.
Yeah.
It's a change in the mix of taxes. Most all of the personal income tax is not exported. A portion of the corporate income tax is exported, so elimination of that affects that 17.5 number.
But that number is this number after your draft reform plan or before?
This is the portion of the increment. It's the portion of the plan that's exported.
Of your new plan.
Yes.
Thank you.
So, just to follow up, this is the net then.
Yes. This is the portion of the revenue from the plan that's exported. Again, this is after we've made the deductibility of 25%.
Just to follow up on what Representative Benz asked, I thought you said that this does not include federal tax effects.
Mr. Co-Chair, that the model does include federal income tax, personal income tax adjustments.
Okay.
So we have in that effect, you see that on our general SIM sheet.
Yeah.
It shows that
And that's included.
Right. That's included in that 17.59. And also, but what's not included is the CAT portion that's deductible on federal tax returns. So we input that first, and then we run the SIM, and then 17.59% of that amount is exported.
Now, other states are a whole lot better than we are at exporting taxes, aren't they? Some other states.
Yes, the best example is Hawaii. They export right. a very large portion of their retail sales.
We go to visit and spend money there.
And you contribute to their public sector.
Right. Thank you. Representative Johnson, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Paul, if you're going to model the CAT's performance from the revenue standpoint in a downturn of 07, 08 dimension, could you also look at what it would do to employment? Because traditionally, in the past, if a company's not making money, they're not paying tax. In this scenario, everybody's going to pay a tax, whether you're profitable or not, and that's got to have an impact on employment. So can you look into that and just see what that will do to our labor market?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, we have managed to Senator Hass, please.
Just one thing I just wanted to I think it was Representative Buehler, somebody mentioned real estate sales, and in the draft, I know realtors in many ways are small businesses, but in the draft, the sale of the house is excluded from the tax. It's in Section 3K, it's only the commissions we're talking about that would be subject to
right.
the tax. So, and I still am really surprised, and I guess that we're talking about 8% of the businesses here. Granted, those are large businesses, but 92% of all business filers are not affected at all. In effect, what we're saying is the new state policy, if we do this, is that the state will not tax small business. We want small business to be a big business. And so a lot of these scenarios we're talking about, I just maybe we all realize this except me, but I'm still surprised that level.
Yeah, I would note on that that there's a bill in the Revenue Committee now that we've already heard a little bit about that further defines sales for the purpose of the current tax system. And I think it essentially mirrors this issue. It's a whole definition of, it's part of the definition of what a sale is. And Co-Chair Hass, I think, has described it very, very well. Colleagues, the House Committee will meet this afternoon at 1 o'clock. I'm still trying to figure out whether we're meeting tomorrow. I don't know whether you're meeting in the morning or not.
Yes, we are. And this meeting, we'll have another joint committee.
We'll have a joint
Tuesday at
On Thursday?
Thursday at the same time.
On Thursday. We'll meet again on Thursday at the same time. Stay tuned for the agenda. And with that, committee, thank you so much for your careful attention today, and committee is adjourned. Careful attention today, and committee is adjourned.